This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Last month, a story in the Financial Times of London, written by my guest Nick Cook, reported that Boeing, the world's biggest aircraft maker, was developing a new project called GRASP, Gravity Research for Advanced Space Propulsion. With this news, anti-gravity, the taboo of the science and aerospace communities, took a step in the direction of legitimate research. My guest, Nick Cook, is a former aviation editor for the military affairs journal Jane's Defense Weekly. Over a decade ago, he stumbled on an obscure news article from the 1950s, which heralded the age of fuel-less superplanes, airships which would use anti-gravity technology to attain the speed of light. He began to investigate covert defense programs funded by the U.S. government in the post-war era and secret research projects spearheaded by Nazi scientists during World War II. His new book, The Hunt for Zero Point, traces the history of the quest for anti-gravity propulsion. I asked Nick Cook what he knew about anti-gravity when he first came across that clipping.
Well, I knew absolutely nothing about anti-gravity propulsion. I mean, it sounded like some sort of really cheesy expression from a science fiction comic or a kind of B-movie or something. But as I understood it, as it pertains to the culture of science fiction and what have you, it was some means of propelling an air vehicle without using fuel. If you can manipulate gravity, I guess a little bit like pushing two positive poles of two magnets together, they kind of repel each other. Well, that sort of was my understanding at that stage of how it could be used and put to use if such an impossible thing existed. But, slowly as I looked into it, it became apparent that there was some science underpinning it. And although I am not a scientist, I enlisted some help. But I am a journalist, and I've covered secret programs for a very long time. And the signals I was getting back were sufficiently interesting in the early days for me to want to continue pursuing it.
What were the most promising theories for how anti-gravity machines would work?
There are many different researchers working in this field, and they all have different pathways to generating an anti-gravity effect. I mean, for instance, what was interesting to me was that many of these anti-gravitational experiments seem to have a common thread. We have, for example, this guy in Russia called Podkletnov, who's using spinning superconductors. We had the German research, which involves the rapid spinning of a kind of rather weird-shaped turbine to produce an anti-gravity effect. There was another German program I uncovered in southern Poland, which again used spinning. Now, what, of course, these have in common is this spinning factor, which, according to some theorists, say if you spin up this zero-point energy field that exists all around us, some weird and magical things start popping out, one of which is an anti-gravitational effect. As I said before, there's no single pathway to this anti-gravitational effect, but there do seem to be many ways of triggering it. Most seem to involve spinning, and a lot seem to involve the input of high doses of electricity.
So at this point, you suspected that this kind of research had been part of a secret black program that the government had supported in the 50s or 60s, maybe. Where did the trail of this black program in anti-gravity research lead you?
Well, the interesting thing about the pronouncements in the mid-1950s, by this range of companies, was that a lot of people were talking about it. And then suddenly, this is in about the 1955 time frame. And then by 1956, 1957, the whole matter had been dropped. And when I look back over papers and magazines and what have you from the period, it was clear that there was, by 1956, 57, it was as if this debate, which had been raging, I mean, people in the New York Times were being quoted in 1955. And it was as if it had never happened. And, there were two reasons for this, I figured. One was maybe it was kind of all a big embarrassment. You know, people had sort of got all carried away with this world-changing technology in 1955, and then suddenly found out there was nothing in it, and it had embarrassed them. Or possibly that it had been shown at that time to be practical and feasible, and someone had realized its world-changing potential and had said to these individuals, shut up about it. And either way, I wanted to to track that down. And that's really how I kind of got sucked into the story. And then surprisingly, although I went out and I looked into kind of contemporary places like NASA and contemporary aerospace and defense companies, and sure enough, there is evidence that stuff is going on today. But what kept on pulling me back was historical data. Even though I wanted to get my teeth into modern programs in the modern world, the evidence was saying that you need to be looking even before 1955 for the origins of this science.
Well, you researched a 1920s scientist, Thomas Townsend Brown. Who was he, and what's his significance in this story?
Well, Brown is a very interesting figure. He came from Ohio. He was a physicist. He studied under a protege of Einstein, and he had some pretty unconventional ideas. He came up with this experiment, which showed that if you charge a capacitor, that's a device that retains electrical charge, positively on its upper side and negatively on its underside, this thing will rise. It will rise in the direction of the positive charge. Now, science has no explanation for this, and yet you can log on to multiple websites on the internet today, and they will teach you how to build something called the lifter, which operates basically on the Brown principle. And you can go and do this in your home using materials like balsa wood, foil, and wire that you can go and buy from a hardware store. But the intriguing aspect is that science has no explanation for how it works.
There is a German chapter to this story. Were the Germans involved in wartime, World War II wartime experiments in anti-gravity?
Yes, they were. The Germans were clearly involved in the Second World War. And this is one of the kind of more disturbing aspects of the story for me. I mean, it was certainly actually one of the more intriguing as well, because my beat is 21st century technology. That's really what I've been trained to do. But I found myself drawn back in time to the Second World War. It's a period I've always been interested in, and it was a period I felt I knew a little bit about. But as I started to uncover what the Germans had been doing, I found that there were two aspects to advanced German high technology during the war. There was the very publicized one, the one that, you know, people like me who are interested in the field know about what the Luftwaffe did, the German Air Force did, during the war, and that in itself was highly advanced. The sinister aspect of the story is that most of the Luftwaffe's high technology was taken over towards the end of the war by the SS. Now, of course, the SS were instrumental in the horrors of the Holocaust, and it became clear, though, it is very clear, that they also had a mandate from the hierarchy, from the senior hierarchy, to get into high technology, to create their own state within a state that would give them power within the framework of the Third Reich.
Well, one of the really interesting characters that you researched was a weapons scientist working for the SS named Kammler. Who was he, and what did he create during the war?
Well, Kammler is a very interesting figure, and he interested me primarily from the outset because he so little is known about him, and yet he was one of the most senior individuals outside of the German cabinet, Hitler's inner circle, during the Second World War. His mandate towards the end of the war was to amass all the high technology that Germany produced during the war, and not only develop it. I mean, for instance, the V-1 and V-2 missiles and rockets that were developed and fired on the Low Countries and on England during the war were under his control at the end of the war. But the most fascinating aspect for me was that Kammler set up a secret research cell in Czechoslovakia, which was ring-fenced even from other high-ranking Germans. And within this research cell, he went beyond. He authorized research into weapons beyond the V-1 and the V-2, which in themselves were highly advanced, and of course became the basis of the rocket program that took Americans to the moon. So Kammler was this mercurial, incredibly unpleasant bureaucrat who had his hands into the architecture of the death camps, for example. But he also took over the German secret weapons as well. And of course, it's significant that at the end of the war, he disappeared off the face of the earth.
He built the largest underground facility in the world, built by concentration camp prisoners, to work on these weapons. And you went there. It's in the Harz Mountains.
Yeah.
What's it like?
The Mittelwerk is a huge underground facility. It's still there. You can go and see it. It was built to construct the V2 rockets and other weapon systems, and it was put underground so that US and UK British strategic bombing during the war couldn't touch it. What is remarkable is that Kammler not only built this facility, which was, as you say, the largest underground facility ever constructed at that time, he also built a rat run of other facilities all across his protectorate, and his protectorate extended from Austria through Czechoslovakia into parts of Germany and what is today southern Poland. And I visited a lot of these facilities, and they are still there. They are subterranean, dank, unpleasant. You can really get a feel for the horrors of their construction, what happened to the people who worked on those construction sites, the construction lines for these weapons during the war. And they leave you with this terrible, sort of indelible imprint, and that was a disturbing time of the research. You come away from it feeling that this stuff kind of sticks to you in a way, and you need to kind of keep your feet on the ground in order to separate the salient facts of the story. And the salient facts of the story are, of course, that Germany developed this stuff, kept it incredibly secret, and then had it, if you like, plundered by the victorious Allies from them at the end of the war.
The United States pursued Nazi scientists after the war, really recruited them. Did they ever get their hands on Kammler's research? I guess the question is, what's the upshot of this World War II Nazi scientist story?
Well, the plant that that Kammler oversaw, it was held, it was actually a sectioned off site of something called the Skoda Works in Czechoslovakia, was designated to be overtaken by the Russians. It was in the Russians' designated zone of influence at the end of the war. What is interesting, though, is that Patton's army, right at the end of the war, in early May, swept in and overtook the Skoda Works for a brief period of time before the Russians got there. Now, what evidence there is suggests that Kammler got a lot of his research out. We don't know where that research went. Some of it may well have gone to Russia. Some of it may well have gone to the United States. The intriguing aspect is we don't know what happened to Kammler. There are four conflicting accounts of his death. None of them stand up to scrutiny. This was the most influential and most important guy at the end of the Second World War, who had all Germany's secret weapons research at his disposal. And somebody like that, of course, would have had a great bargaining chip to deal with any of the victors, the victorious allies that he cared to have chosen to deal with, to bargain for his life, because Kammler needed to bargain for his life. He was the man who helped to build up the death camps. He had a bureaucratic vision for how the death camps should be created. He was an architect, one of the architects of the Holocaust. So he needed very firmly to bargain for his life, and this would have been a definite bargaining chip, all this high technology.
Nick Cook is an aerospace consultant for the military affairs journal Jane's Defense Weekly. His new book about the history of anti-gravity research is The Hunt for Zero Point. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Nick Cook. He's a former aviation editor for the military affairs journal Jane's Defense Weekly. His new book about the history of anti-gravity research is The Hunt for Zero Point. You followed up on these questions of what happened to the Nazis' wartime research, and you found some interesting stuff. What did you find once you dug around? Who was involved in anti-gravity research in the 50s in the U.S.?
Well, the interesting thing about the 1950s research in the U.S. was that just about every aerospace company you've ever heard of was involved in the field. In 1955, a range of companies like Lockheed, Convair, Bell, these big names from the US aerospace industry from the time, were all talking about, you know, this coming revolution, the anti-gravity revolution, and that all they needed was some input from the US government in terms of support and funding, and they could crack the science. And to me, what was intriguing was that there was an echo here of what was happening or what had been happening in the pre-Second World War years with fission, with atomic science, where the community was very much divided. You had those saying that if you split an atom, you could get an enormous release of energy, enough perhaps to make a bomb. And those within the field, physicists working within the field, who said it's absolutely impossible. And of course, in the mid-1950s, where these guys were talking about anti-gravity research in the same light, the community was riven with the same kind of dissent, those who said it was possible and those who said it was impossible. So there is this kind of intriguing echo. And again, that gave me some confidence that it was worth pursuing, because we know now the terrible consequences of the atomic bomb.
Why wouldn't people talk to you about this now? I mean, we've been hearing a lot about black programs in recent years on weaponry during the Cold War, about the atom bomb and programs that were cloaked by the CIA, the stealth fighter, for instance. Why hasn't this story surfaced, and why would people still be reluctant to talk to you about it?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why this story hasn't surfaced, and one of them is that the work is fundamentally, that the potential of this work is world-changing. If you can crack the anti-gravity conundrum, you are not just into something that will change the aerospace industry, you're into something that is going to change our entire world. You can get, according to the people who work in this field, anything to run off this technology. You are manipulating the forces of nature. You are bending the fundamental forces of nature and getting energy from it. Now, that is powerful and it is limitless. So if they can crack this technology, and the evidence suggests that they already have, then it would be incredibly secret. But of course, there's another aspect too, which is that this has been a kind of giggle factor because of its science fiction type connotations for ages. And you know, you've got to have some nerve to stick your head above the parapet. And that is undoubtedly another factor as well, which has kept this below the kind of the public, the out of the public eye. So, you know, these things, I think they all combine to have made it something which has not broken through into the mainstream. But of course, the real draw now is that people are beginning to realize that we are running out of time when it comes to things like fossil fuel. And we need to be looking at alternative power sources if we're going to go through the 21st century and survive into the 22nd.
Could you give us the big picture then on this story? What's the larger significance of anti-gravity research during the Cold War? Does it tell you something about how once taboo and outlandish ideas in science then become mainstream?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I think, as I say at the end of the book, even in the short or relatively short period of time it took me to write it, ideas and the acceptance of ideas, people have become much more tolerant, I think, to ideas which, you know, previously people needed to be kind of rooted in real things that they could touch and see and feel. And science is very much like that. Scientists want all the time to have theory underpinning work to enable them to remain grounded at all times. I too have great sympathy with that. And in my job, I've always wanted to be grounded, to go out and touch the things that I'm writing about, like, you know, stealth fighters or what have you. So, but I think attitudes have changed and they are changing. And Zero Point is always grounded in real work. And mercifully, there are a lot of scientists who are really working right on the cutting edge at the moment. There is a great guy called Dr. Hal Puthoff, works down in Texas, who is really pioneering this whole zero-point energy field and coming up with really respectable theories for how zero-point energy, which is a kind of all-embracing field of energy around us, it's proven to exist. It's simply that we don't know what it can do for us. But Puthoff is one of those people who believes that zero-point energy could actually explain things like gravity, which science has very little explanation for. And I think these answers very soon are going to pop out of the woodwork. I think we're really on the cusp of a whole new era in science and understanding. And if nothing else, that's what I'd like this book to do, is to get these principles to be debated openly without fear of ridicule.
Nick Cook, thanks. It's been an interesting time talking with you today.
Thank you.
Nick Cook's new book is The Hunt for Zero Point. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.